I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Howard Richler joins me again. He's got a new book out that's just a terrific read. The book is called How Happy Became Homosexual and Other Mysterious Semantic Shifts. It's a fascinating. It's such a fascinating book that you'll be going back to it frequently. In his inimitable style, Howard Richler educates and enlightens us with the history of a number of words, gives us their etymology, and how their usage has changed its meaning over the centuries. It's rather neat to see how some words have completely different meanings and their intent. Mr. Richler writes columns on language for various newspapers, and he's published six previous books, including the one he was on with 3 years ago, Strange Bedfellows, The Private Lives of Words. The book is published by Ronsdale Press. Follow Howard on Twitter. His handle, at Howard Richler, and is at Howard Richler, and he regularly has a great fact or word puzzle. His blog, Word Nerd, is at howardrichler.blogspot.ca. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program in Montreal, Howard Richler. Mr. Richler, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Thank you for joining us. It's good to talk again. The fascinating thing about this book is to see how language evolves. What have you found are some words that we use today frequently that have changed dramatically in the last century or so? Not going back hundreds of years, but just in the last little while.
Well, I mean, some of the words, and it's what's interesting is that, I mean, there are certain words where a word was used in a certain way, perhaps 150 years ago. People don't really argue about it, like something like obsequious, but a good example is the word decimate. You have certain pedants who would argue, decimate has to mean killing one-tenth because mm-hmm. of the fact that coming from the Latin. But the reality with language is a very democratic process. And when I say, it's hard to say what the exact number is, but when at least 80% of people use a word in a certain way, that becomes the definitive way of using it. And that's a good example of a word that has effectively changed meanings. And if you use decimate to refer to only killing one-tenth, most people will be confused. So even though it's etymologically incorrect, it's a democratic process. So that would be, let's say, one example of a word. So you're talking about words which have changed fairly recently. Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, the word "gay" is obviously one which was the inspired the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of interesting. I find sometimes when I've given talks, people get particularly exercised, and they ask me how did the homosexual community co-opt this word, and they get rather upset. In fact, I can remember one person turning purple in the face, and I could just see this man going apoplectic when he's saying, "Don, we now are gay apparel," you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, gay is a word that really obviously comes to people's minds in terms of a rapid change in meaning, to the point that if you use gay to mean, to be in a happy mood, it's very likely, it's highly unlikely you're going to be understood.
And the interesting thing about that word gay is in the last, say, 20 years or so, it's also meant something else, and it's almost a pejorative in that it means, say, uncool, lame, even.
Yeah, exactly. Like the party was like so lame. Mm. You hear teenagers using that all the time, and so like gay has morphed even to a greater extent. Where I think people under 25 probably would use it. That would be the predominant way that people would use the word.
Yeah. Does it frustrate you when people use the word wrongly and thus change its meaning? I mean, are you a pedant in that sense?
No, because it's always been. I mean, I point out in my book, certain people have gone apoplectic about words which nowadays seem so silly, like Samuel Coleridge, the poet. What drove him to distraction was people used talented to mean gifted, because talent to him was a coin. As in used in the Bible, so he said, "Well, why not say shilling or farthing?" So the thing is that things have been changing ever since, and the reality is, Shakespeare may have used a nice girl may have been a lascivious girl to Shakespeare, And, you know, sometimes it still has that connotation, but, you know, it usage dictates the way what words mean, and that's the way it is. It does get tricky at times. Sometimes when we're in the process, words are changing, and you're not really quite sure. Like a good example is the word fulsome.
Uh-huh.
Until recently, a fulsome praise was, like, very critical. It started around 20 years ago to be used in a positive sense. Now, another thing which has happened recently, and I see this all the time on Power and Politics with Evan Solomon and other politicians, they're using fulsome to mean full.
Mm.
And that is technically incorrect. But the point is, when everybody starts using something incorrectly, it becomes right. It's just a process of language, and I think it's probably a greater process of the English language than other languages, because English language is a very chaotic, flexible language. I would argue that it's really one of its inherent strengths that we don't get hung up with academies the way a lot of other languages
do. French.
And we accept the democratic nature of language, whereas the French, in many cases, don't. You know, and a lot of attempts to try to legislate usage are totally futile, because it just doesn't work.
Well, we've talked in the past about the Oxford English Dictionary. I guess that's the great arbiter in our language, right?
I would regard it as such. It is a British-based dictionary, and it is. You know, there's not like one final arbiter of language. I mean, some dictionaries would sort of state that there's a distinct difference between infer and imply. Other ones would say that there isn't. So there's not like one sort of Bible, the thing is, in some cases, some dictionaries may be more correct than another one about a certain word because they've updated an entry more recently. And that's the only reason that it may be more correct. I mean, you see that with a good example is the word marriage.
Uh-huh.
I mean, 25 years ago, if you said marriage could imply same-sex unions, people would have looked at you like you're crazy. But even dictionaries now include same-sex, most dictionaries include same-sex union. So you know that once it's on a lexicographic nature, that there's really been a massive change in society.
And so how fast does the OED reflect sort of changes in society? Not as fast as some other dictionaries or other publications, say?
Well, I think it is fairly fast, but, you know, there is a process. The OED's been going through a process since the year 2000 of revising all its entries, and it's sort of a strange process. They started in the middle of the dictionary, the letter M, and they've been going all the way, and I think they're more than halfway through right now. But you have some of the entries which, you know, may be between A and L, which they haven't got to yet, which, you know, haven't been revised. And the thing is that they will revise randomly a lot of entries along the way throughout the dictionary if they think it's really required. But, you know, the point is, obviously, now and then they're going to miss something which should have been revised and hasn't been revised yet. So, the thing that's also happening with the OED is that the vocabulary is advancing, exploding in size for two major reasons. You have a lot of words coming into the language because of technology.
Uh-huh.
And probably the bigger reason is that finally there are the resources to include the other Englishes. So, you know, at this point, it's almost an argument to say whether there's an English language or English languages.
Yeah.
And in fact, obviously, there's a lot more people who speak English in India than who speak it in Canada. And increasingly, that's where the growth in English is, in second language speakers. And these forms of English are becoming more and more important. And so we see this process where you increasingly have to be bilingual in your own language.
Now, are there specific people that can affect language? Like, I mean, if the president starts using certain words or a cultural figure like that, there can be some change that comes about, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, obviously when important people use certain words, and sometimes this a word explodes, like, out of nowhere. Like, who heard of Chad before the issue? Who heard of, well, some people have heard of paparazzi, but, you know, the situation with Princess Diana, like, made that work very, you know. So certain situations create a word which really, where the word really explodes. Ground zero is another word which probably exploded. And it's sort of interesting because that's a good example. Ground zero originally just referred to the place immediately underneath where a bomb went off. And now we use ground zero to mean a lot of things. So as I point out in my book, there's a very strong metaphorical nature of language. So you could see like a lot of situations where myopia may at one point just referred to an eye situation, yeah. But then you can use it as a metaphor. So in a sense, every word is a poem, and this is one of the reasons that I'm so fascinated by words, because I just find there's so much, you know, inside every word.
The other thing when reading this book, it's very funny. I mean, it's occasionally very funny, and you seem like you're having a lot of fun writing it, are you?
A lot of fun. What I've tried to do in this book is I tried to be intellectually and academically vigilant, but my audience here are not academics. My audience here are people who, you know, like word nerds, logophiles like me, who just love the language. And so I'm trying to get across, you know, the idea that language can be a lot of fun and entertaining.
Yeah. Did you find that young people have an interest in sort of etymology and linguistics as you do?
Not particularly. And yeah. Nowadays, no. I think this it's sort of dying off a bit. The reality is, I was one of those classic word nerds when I think I was like 10 years old. I would sneak into the bathroom and read a dictionary. It definitely was not fashionable probably it's not overly fashionable right now, but probably it was even less fashionable at the time. But I don't think young people generally are into language. They're into conforming, and they're into using language in a way that doesn't make them stand out, which is why everybody uses the same expressions all the time, I think. And hopefully people outgrow that by the time they get into their 30s, but unfortunately they don't always, so not much we can do about that.
Yeah. There's marvelous sections in the book, words that are, say, generally good, they become pejoratives.
Mm-hmm.
What's one that we might recognize that we didn't know was actually a good thing before?
Well, like, for example, silly is a good example, because what I find also interesting about language is it reflects social change. So silly originally, it didn't always mean foolish. At one point, it almost had the sense to be silly was to be possessed of the grace of God. So it was sort of like you have this concept in Christianity, the fools of God, who are more liable to take in God's grace. And another example is the word a Cretan. A Cretan originally just meant Christian, which, you know, the idea that, you know, perhaps you were intellectually challenged made you more a God's child. Nowadays, we don't see that as any advantage. And it's sort of interesting, if you look at all the deadly sins, pride, uh-huh. Not really considered too bad anymore, greed, not really that bad. Envy, or maybe a little bit. Lust is not really criticized too much. Wrath, gluttony, sloth. I mean, some of them are still seen pejoratively, but generally there's been a process where there's been definitely an amelioration of those words. But in terms of like your original question, like lewd is another word. Lewd, L-E-W-D, once referred to any member of the laity. And generally, you see this process in language that words relative to the lower classes, like vulgar, this meant like a common person. You see, a villain was just somebody who lived in a villa. And on the other end of the coin, you have like words like noble, which was at one point was just an accident of birth. So words that are relative to classes, and obviously words relative to women, tend to go downhill.
On amelioration, when words become nice, right. What's the joke about the difference between a good girl and a nice girl?
Oh, the difference between a good girl. I think I first heard this joke when I was 15, and I found it hilarious at the time. But the difference is that a good girl goes to the party, goes home, then goes to bed, whereas the nice girl goes to the party, goes to bed, then goes home.
Yeah.
And what I found interesting is in recalling this joke, writing this book, is that there are some entries in the Oxford English Dictionary from Shakespeare which bear that out, because in Antony and Cleopatra, Antony tells his beloved, "When mine hours were nice and lucky, men did ransom lives," So in some cases, there's truth to these jokes. And nice is an example of that. It's meant like everything under the sun. It's meant ignorance. It's meant lustful, extravagant. And it's only really at the beginning of the 19th century that it starts to mean pleasant.
Yeah.
So we think of that as the definitive meaning of the word. That is fairly recent.
One word that I found interesting, because it's been in the news a lot because of Elizabeth II's jubilee, is the word jubilee and how that's changed.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting. It's sort of interesting. There is a Jewish part to jubilee, as it turns out. Not that it's spelled J-E-W, but jubilee is a term which is found in the Bible, and it refers to a period of years that were, that were prosperous. So it's sort of interesting that, it just doesn't sound like anything at all. In fact, in the OED it says it's the year of emancipation and restoration, which according to the institution in Leviticus 25 was to be kept every 50 years to be proclaimed by a blast of trumpets. So I suppose that the idea of the musical blare is, has taken on the sense of jubilee as a time of joy.
Yeah.
And what's interesting with a lot of words, a lot of these words were actually first introduced into English by people who translated the Hebrew Bible. And, that's where that word actually came into English, I think, in the 14th century.
And then I guess with Victoria and now Elizabeth II, 60,
right.
It could mean jubilee as well, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking on the internet, so this would be, a podcast. But I like to think of it as a broadcast in
mm-hmm.
the sense of transmitting, say, a radio program.
Mm-hmm.
The word broadcast itself, what did it mean originally?
If I remember, broadcast referred to the sowing of seeds,
mm.
And then it came to refer to the dissemination of news. So again, it's a classic example of the metaphorical use of language, and we see this in a lot of situations where, of course, when particularly with technology, of course, you can invent new words, but another way of doing it is you take words like icon and mouse, and whatever, and you give them other meanings. So this is why you see some entries in the dictionary and they go on and on. It's I think that the word which has more senses now than any one in the Oxford English Dictionary is the word run. It just recently surpassed set,
huh.
And you can it's sort of like reading a book. Just reading all the entries on a single word.
Have you found, because you mentioned earlier about India being the largest number of, having the largest number of English speakers, I have an Indian friend who uses the word queue to mean lineup, and
mm-hmm.
people around us are starting to use that word again. And you also see that in British sitcoms and the sort.
Right.
Have you found any influence from, say, the Asian languages like Chinese or Japanese?
Yeah, a certain amount. I mean, the situation of Q. I mean, Q is the standard word in England for lining up.
Yeah.
People will queue, and it's during World War II was considered a patriotic duty to queue. I mean, what's also interesting in Indian English is that sometimes they will use certain words in English which haven't been used anywhere else for like 200 words. So, like for example, in India, not only can you postpone, you can prepone something.
Yeah.
And some of the expressions are really, really colorful. Like a big mistake is a Himalayan blunder in Indian English. So they have some really, I think sexual discrimination is called eve teasing in India. So there's a lot of expressions that. But you know, in terms of what you said, like with Chinese and Japanese, you see like certain words. But I mean, a lot of them are really a lot of them are food words. But there are certain words which have come into English from Asian languages, which don't have that connotation. Like gung ho is a word which came in from Chinese. So you do have a certain amount of words that do come in from Asian languages.
Yeah, and I guess as you said earlier, technology seems to spur changes in our language. So we're not in a period of any settling in our language right now, right?
No, not at all. I think if anything, it's sort of like the universe. The expansion is even increasing, and I think this is like vexing for some people because some people like order in life, and English is not an orderly language. But it's just the nature of the beast. There are some standards. I mean, obviously, I think even though you have the other Englishes gaining an influence, you do have two major forms of English: British English and American English. And I think when people now that English has become the lingua franca, when people meet from around the world who speak different Englishes, Sort of a toned-down American English has sort of become the standard, for a language that everybody can speak and understand. Well, but, I mean, I think it's just something that we do anyway. So when we speak to children, we don't use certain words that, you know, they may, you know, them, that, you know, at least it's something that we should do. We should try to tailor our language so that people will understand what we're saying.
I never use who and whom correctly. Will things like that, will that change so that I don't have to worry?
I think so. I mean, who and whom I suspect will be more abundant in 20 years. Huh. The reality is, I mean, like, I don't know anybody who says, whom do you trust? You know, like, if this doesn't sound right, and like, as some of these rules are, they don't really serve any purpose of communication. English doesn't have that many of them, but one is supposed to use, you know, fewer and less and different connotations. If you misuse the word, people will understand it. So I imagine even there, over time, you'll see that the use of fewer is going to diminish. But you know, and I think you have a distinction between written English and spoken English. When we speak, I mean, very few people, you know, fewer people will use a word correctly, like making a distinction between who and whom. And I think that now that we have that so many people are communicating in writing electronically, the distinction between written and spoken is really, it's getting a little bit hazy.
Yeah.
So I think even there, the what's regarded as the standard for the spoken is going to dominate.
You've been well otherwise?
I have been well otherwise. I'm getting older, like the rest of us, but it's better than the alternative.
It's so good to talk again, Howard.
It's been a blast.
Yeah, I love this book. And I urge people to pick it up because it's a fun book. You'll also learn a great deal. Continued good luck with it.
But can you also ask them, aside from picking it up, to pay for it?
To pay for it, exactly.
Because that's a problem too. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. At Howard Richler is the Twitter handle. Word Nerd is the blog. It's at howardrichler.blogspot.ca. The book is called How Happy Became Homosexual and Other Mysterious Semantic Shifts. It's from Ronsdale Press. Its author, Howard Richler, on the line from Montreal and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.